Hi, my name is Robert McMahon. I'm the Connection Director here at Covenant Church, and I'm thrilled that you're listening. If you're checking us out for the first time, welcome. We're so glad that you're here, and I'd like to take this chance to invite you to let us know that you're tuning in today. We'd love nothing more than to help you start building meaningful relationships and to join you on the journey of faith. Just go to bgcovenant.org/connect and let us know how we can be in touch. With that said, let's dive in and listen together to this week's message.
But I am Jordan Browning, that is my name. My wife Emily and I have been attending and members here at Covenant for the last 4 or 5 years or so. We have 3 little kids, a 4th on the way, so you can be praying for us. But I have the privilege of continuing our series through the names of God as found in the Old Testament this morning. And the name that we have this morning is this, Jehovah Makadosh Kem. Quite a mouthful this morning, right? But this simply means the Lord who sanctifies you. And 2 things before we transition off this slide. First, the root of that verb, Makadosh Kem, is just Kadesh, the Hebrew word meaning holy or sacred or to sanctify. And so this is about God sanctifying. And that last section there, the Kem, or if I was an actual Jewish person, I could say chem better, but that's a plural you. That's saying the Lord who sanctifies y'all. I'm going to be getting a little southern this morning. I'm not from the South, but I'm going to be saying that a few times, the Lord who sanctifies y'all, because I don't want us to forget that part of this name. But like I mentioned, not from the South. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. That's where I grew up. It might come as some surprise that I found something interesting going on in the University of Michigan. I hate to admit it. I mean, it's a great school, whatever. We'll beat them at football someday, right? Yes, someday, Jackson. But there's this Michigan professor. He's in their Department of Health and Behavioral Health Education. His focus is on people's health and well-being, but more specifically, he's been focusing on human purpose and its significance. He has this free class that you can go right now and sign up for. It's called Finding Purpose and Meaning in Life, Living for What Matters Most. And in the description of this course, he promises that you will understand having a strong purpose in life is an essential element to human well-being. The fancy way of just saying purpose and meaning in life is important. He's not claiming to say anything new. This isn't; these aren't new pursuits. But I think that he's identifying maybe a little crisis of purpose that we have in our country specifically right now. There's 2 studies that have been done that I want us to take a look at. One was monitoring high school seniors. We have the graph. And the percentage who graduated, it's hard to read the dates there, but up to 2018, the percentage of high school seniors who graduated and expressed the feeling life often feels meaningless, often being the key word there. And you'll notice, well, maybe you can't read it, but around 2010, 2011, things really started to spike. And this goes till 2018. So I would have to imagine that with COVID, it would only just continue to trend upward. But think of this, by 2018, around 20%, over 20%, 1 out of every 5 high school seniors was saying that life often feels meaningless. And before that, we assumed this might be just a young person problem. There was a study done by a Christian research group called Lifeway Research in 2021, and they published a study where they surveyed over 1,200 U.S. adults, and they asked this question: how often do you wonder, how can I find more meaning and purpose in my life? And we have the pie chart summary of their findings there. I'll do the quick math for you. 57% of these adults admitted to wondering that question at least once a month, if not more. In the same study, if you read the article, the same study was done in 2011, so 10 years previous, and that number was 51%. Of adults who had admitted to wondering, how can I find more meaning and purpose in my life? So in 10 years, not a wild increase, but an increase nonetheless, from 51% to 57%. So let's imagine, as maybe an absurd hypothetical, that 20% of our high school seniors, 57% of us as adults, we had suddenly forgotten our left from our right. I would imagine that as you got in the car this morning to head back home, you would think twice about trusting the turn signal in front of you, maybe. Or when you head to Kroger and you're about to turn the aisle, you might be like kind of bracing for a crash. We might start using cardinal directions more because I can't trust if Sally just gave me the right directions to her house or something. But all this to say, this is a lot of people. This is a significant amount of us, and maybe some of us in this room who are wrestling with questions of meaning and purpose. It's in the air we breathe. What is life all about? Is there meaning to be found? What's my purpose? Now, I want us to hold this intention over here as we transition back to our name for God this morning, the Lord who sanctifies y'all, Jehovah Makodesh Kem. This name for God first shows up in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus is simply a title meaning belonging to the Levites. This was one of the 12 tribes of Israel. They were charged with essentially keeping the tabernacle and later the temple, all the duties and responsibilities and sacrifices with that. It's not a perfect correlation, but you could almost think of them as the church staff of the ancient Israelites. So it's here in the book of Leviticus, chapter 20, God is speaking to Moses, the leader of the Israelite people, and he tells them, he's in the midst of giving them this long list where he's extrapolating and expounding on the Ten Commandments, and in the midst of it, he shares these two verses, sort of as just like an aside. He shares these two verses to Moses, and again, this is being communicated by God to Moses, who is then he's supposed to communicate this to the rest of the people. And so he says this in Leviticus 20, 7 and 8. We're using the Tree of Life version again, which we've used previously in this series. It says this, "So consecrate yourselves and be holy, for I am Adonai your God. You are to keep my statutes and do them. I am Adonai who sanctifies you." And just by way of reminder, that word Adonai, the reason it's there in this translation is because the ancient Israelites, they would not, out of reverence, they would not have read the word Yahweh, where we get our word Jehovah. And so out of reverence, they would have read Adonai out loud, which means Lord. And I think it might be helpful for us to briefly address the elephant in the room. Anyone in here huge Leviticus fans? Anyone big? No? If I could gift you all 30 minutes tomorrow morning of uninterrupted time with your favorite beverage where you get to spend in prayer and in scripture, how many of us would be giddy with anticipation and excitement because finally I get to look into the law codes and the dietary restrictions and the sacrificial regulations? I'm guessing not many of us. It's probably a book that's most known for destroying many well-intentioned desires to read through the Bible in a year in January. I'm not saying that out of judgment, I've been there. But briefly, Leviticus falls as the third book within the Hebrew Bible's first five books known as the Pentateuch, Penta 5. This is essentially the origin story of Judaism, and it's helpful to know that this comes within the context of these five books, as opposed to just simply this random book with a bunch of laws and rules that feel out of context and out of sorts with the New Testament. So it's here that we get the origin story for Judaism, and then Paul is going to later explain in the New Testament epistles that this is the origin story for us as well as Christians. Let's take a look at this picture really quick. As a true, full-fledged, unashamed millennial, this is my Spider-Man. I know there are others, but imagine with me that we did not understand the origin story of Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man, which, to be honest, I don't know a ton, but I know it involves getting bit by a radioactive spider. He has this moment with Uncle Ben, right, where he can't save him, something like that. But imagine we popped on Spider-Man. We didn't know that about it, and we just see a guy in spider-themed spandex. We're wondering, is this a Halloween movie? No, because no one else is dressed like this. But he's swinging around on webs. What's the spider thing going on? Is he law enforcement? No, I don't think so, because he's still like beating, he's trying to fight crime. I don't understand. So it would be hard to figure out what is going on if we did not understand the origin story. Like, why the spider theme? Why the specific superpowers that he has, right? What are his motivations? And similarly, If we were to just skip ahead and go right to Jesus, for someone that doesn't understand the Old Testament, Jesus can feel a little confusing out of context. How did we get this Jewish Messiah? What is Messiah? What does that even mean? Who was both fully God and fully man. He defeats the powers of sin and death by dying on the cross. That seems backwards. But he was resurrected to new life. Did this guy just come out of nowhere? It's not Halloween. No one else is dressed up. What's going on? Well, the first five books of the Bible, they help us get started and lead us to Jesus eventually. Genesis begins with God creating out of nothing and then essentially giving us for 50 chapters the founding fathers of the faith. And by the time we get to Exodus, there is the nation of people now. They are a full nation, but unfortunately, they are living in the land of Egypt and they are slaves. They are a nation of slaves. Exodus chapter 12 actually tells us that they've been enslaved for 430 years. That's not a short time. So we have to picture this before we get to Leviticus, that we have a whole nation of people, literally all they have known for 430 years is being ruled and controlled by somebody else. And then, by God's saving power and Moses' leadership, this nation is now free and no longer under foreign rule. They don't yet have a land. That's to come later in the narrative, as you'll read, but they're wandering in the wilderness, but at least they're free. So when your life is not your own, you've been controlled by others, and then all of a sudden you're given freedom, how are you supposed to know what to do with that freedom? I think our own country's history, unfortunately, gives a telling parallel. And this is where Leviticus fits within the narrative of what's going on at the beginning of the Bible, and specifically ancient Israel. It's not simply a book about making sure God's people follow the right rules or eat the right foods or make the right sacrifices or earn their righteousness. There will be, those things will be a part of what Leviticus is doing. But Leviticus is crucial because it's the result of a gracious God who recognizes that this group of people, this nation that I've just rescued, has zero clue how to live for me now that they've been rescued and given freedom. And now they need structure. We've talked in the past as a church about what it looks like to live an upstream kind of life, swimming upstream, and I think Leviticus provides some upstream pushback on our current modern-day definitions of freedom. Even consider our own stories as believers. Apart from Christ, Paul tells us that we were completely and utterly dead in our sin, and that through faith in Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, we were made alive in him. This is our own Exodus story, right? This is our own freedom out of captivity. But what have we been saved into? Well, there's a whole new way of life opened for us. We've been given the Holy Spirit. There's the triune God who's in charge and on the throne. Paul will say, we don't go from a bad master, sin and death, to no master at all. We go from a bad master to being under the rule and reign of Jesus now, the Lord of all, the Lord of heaven and earth. And this is actually good news. Right, I love the way author Fleming Rutledge puts it. She says, to be lorded over by Jesus Christ is to be truly free for the first time. So how did God set up for the Israelites this freedom? What did it look like for them to live for him now as a nation no longer under slavery? What were the mechanics of this all? Well, in a word, if we had to sum up the book, it might be easy to sum it up as holiness. But still, Leviticus can be a little confusing. I'm going to read here a paragraph from an Old Testament scholar who summarizes the mechanics of holiness and how it works within the book of Leviticus. He says this, "Everything in life was either holy or common for the Hebrews. Those things determined common were subdivided into categories of clean and unclean. Clean things might become holy through sanctification or unclean through pollution. Holy things could be profaned and become common or even unclean. Unclean things could be cleansed and then consecrated or sanctified to be made holy. Common things or persons devoted to God became holy through the mutual efforts of human activity in sanctifying or consecrating, and the Lord as the sanctifier." This graphic we could put up afterwards. It helps summarize a little bit what this guy has said, the process of sanctification. That's a pretty wordy paragraph. So he put together this graphic to help us sort of visualize what he's saying. And we have to be a little careful on this side of the cross. When we see words like unclean and profane, it's easy to read into those words like a moral designation, that means sin. So when we go back and read Leviticus, it's confusing. So you're telling me if I have a skin disease, I'm unclean, so I'm sinful? Well, the book of Leviticus is just trying to say you're in a state of uncleanliness. And so what's the path that gets us towards cleanliness again, but not just stay there? Actually, for us as a people to be holy so that the holy God can live with us and among us. And there will be things, the sinfulness will lead to being in states of uncleanliness for sure, but that's not all that's going on in the book of Leviticus. The ultimate concern is what does it look like for a God who is known as the Lord who sanctifies you? How does he then live among a people who are constantly in flux between cleanliness and uncleanliness? What does it look like? Well, he is the one who actually makes them holy. He does the sanctifying work in the end. And this is just what sanctification is. It's a fancy church word maybe, but coming from the Latin sanctus, just meaning holy. Consider time. I think we understand intuitively, even if we don't use the word sanctification a lot, we understand what's meant by it. It's simply setting something aside for a unique purpose. Again, with time, this is something that people will say often, right? I've set aside time for X, Y, or Z. We're in the middle of, we're officially, as of yesterday, right, in summer, and I'm sure many of us have begun thinking about or planning or even have already had their vacations. We set aside time for vacation. Out of the normal routines and schedules, we slice out this chunk of time and we say, this is going to be for something unique and different. So maybe on vacation, I'm not checking my work email. Maybe I get to spend time with people that I don't normally get to see. Maybe I'm emerging from one body of water, this black swamp, and I'm going to another body of water, the ocean, where it's nice, where it's a different kind of warmth that we're going to get over the next couple days. There's waves, and there's a lot to enjoy. So vacation time is sacred to us, right? It's been consecrated by us. It's sanctified, if you will, for a certain kind of living. And in the middle of February, on a Tuesday, when you're freezing in Northwest Ohio and you're scraping ice off your windshield, you're layering up, that is not the recipe for a vacation for most of us, I'm guessing. We're living a different kind of life then. And like a vacation, Leviticus is actually telling us that to be a part of the people of God, a God who goes by the name the Lord who sanctifies you, we are the thing that has been set aside for something unique, for something special with meaning and with purpose. Then the New Testament is going to pick this up, and we're going to look at a few verses from the book of Hebrews, a book that draws a ton from Leviticus and the first few books of the Old Testament. We're going to look at Hebrews 9, 11 to 14 together, and it says this, "But when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made with human hands, that is to say, is not part of this creation. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves," Leviticus stuff, "but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. The blood of goats and bulls and ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean," there's our word, "sanctify them so that they are outwardly clean. How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death so that we might serve the living God?" Now, there's a lot there we could unpack, but what I want us to pay attention to this morning is the logic of Hebrews 9 here, where the author says that if the Levitical sacrificial regulations, if they can sanctify you outwardly, it said. And I think we need to hear that word outwardly and think temporarily, or for the time being. The author says, how much more then is Christ's death on the cross able to sanctify you internally? If you recall, the language of the verse said, how much more will the blood of Christ cleanse our consciences, internal cleansing, from acts that lead to death? So if outwardly intends temporarily or for the time being, internally suggests being sanctified for good, for all time. again, to use the language, eternal redemption has been obtained. So the vacation never ends. The set-aside life, not just as an individual Christian, but as the y'all, the set-aside life never ends. Now, before we move on from this section of Hebrews, I think it's important to return to the last phrase, because we still haven't addressed what we have been set aside for. So if you look here again, the way this section ended with that last phrase, so that we might serve the living God. God's name as the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, who sanctifies y'all, who sanctifies us, it's not just communicating helpful intellectual information for us to store in our brains about God. It's communicating that we're actually a part of something. We've been invited into a plan, invited into purpose, invited into meaning, and that's headed somewhere. So how might we sum this all up? How might we kind of wrap this up in one sentence? We have been set aside so that we might serve the living God. I want to return really briefly to that Lifeway research study that was done back in 2021 where they asked the adults, how often do you wonder, how can I find more meaning or purpose in my life? And there's a paragraph that struck me from the guy who summarized the findings, Aaron Earls. We'll read this paragraph together. He says this: among Christians, the more often they attend church, the more likely they are to say that they have found a higher purpose and meaning for their life. Half of those who attend less than once a month, 51%, say that they've found such meaning for their life, compared to 69% of those who attend 1 to 3 times a month, and 76% of those who attend 4 times a month or more. Now, to be extra clear, this is not about guilt-tripping us to be at church more. I'm not on church staff here. I have no invested interest in you necessarily being here next week. But if you ask the elders, I'm sure that they would say the same thing, right? Attendance is not actually the goal. But what I think Aaron Earls is trying to identify here is that it's what happens when you do attend more, right? As I mentioned before, or actually as Andrew mentioned, my wife and I work for Crew. It's a campus ministry where we seek to reach students with the gospel. We want to build them up in their faith and send them out after graduation to live for Him. I'm the team leader. I lead the staff and students there. And I think part of what keeps me going as I get older, but college students stay the same age, is my own story as a freshman and sophomore at Ohio State. I graduated with 73 from high school, and then I went to an undergrad university with 50,000 plus. So it was quite a change. At a school that size, you literally are a number. They give you a dot number, is what it's called at Ohio State, which is essentially your email. My email was browning.140@osu.edu, meaning I was the 140th person who had enrolled at the Ohio State University with the last name Browning. And so that was my email. I asked my friend Adam Smith as I was preparing for this because I was curious. He was smith.11244, and he's been graduated for many years now. So I have to imagine an incoming freshman with the last name Smith. I mean, gosh, may God have mercy on their soul. I don't know. Anyway, it's a huge school. Easy to feel lost, easy to feel alone, and I can remember exactly where I was walking downhill from Independence Hall to the rec center when I was praying to God as a freshman, asking simply for friends. I was commuting from home, I didn't have community, and I was craving it really badly. So fast forward to my sophomore year. The husband of one of my high school teachers actually was working for Crew at Ohio State at the time, and he invited me to a Bible study that was held at his house. And I had been to Bible studies before, but in middle school and high school, there was always this air of like, at least the ones I attended, we're kind of there because our parents want us to be, right, sort of, or I know that this is the right thing to do, so that's why I'm here. But at a school like Ohio State where there's so many people, like no one's forcing you to do anything. And so the people that are at those things, at a Bible study, they want to be there because they want to be there. And that really struck me when I showed up as a sophomore. These guys were into the Bible in a way that I had not seen before. They would like argue and debate with each other, but they were great friends. They would hang out after the Bible study. And I couldn't help, as a sophomore, but get kind of caught up in the gravitational pull of what was going on within their community. And it completely changed my experience at Ohio State. Now, as a Christian, did my fundamental meaning and purpose in life as a follower of Christ, did it change from my freshman year to my sophomore year simply because I got more involved in CRU, the student org? No. But to emphasize what I think that study we highlighted earlier found, the more that I was around, the more that I got involved, the more that I showed up, the more I served and got caught up into the mission of what CRU does, the more that I experienced that meaning and purpose. Because relationships happened, bonds formed, I got caught up in the y'all. Two of the guys in that Bible study stood in my wedding. We're going to spend a week in Milwaukee with one of those guys and his family. So these relationships have lasted much longer than us simply being in college together. Now, college friendships are unique, and I'm not trying to say that we need to replicate what I experienced at Ohio State. Now, when you're in your 40s and you have kids growing up, like the point is not to try to replicate this, but rather, it's to emphasize why I've made it such a point this morning to emphasize that plural you in our name, the Lord who sanctifies y'all. We have been set aside so that we might serve the living God together, like Hebrews said. And the stats seem to back this up. The more that we're together, the more that you're here, the more you're going to find meaning and purpose and the abundant life Jesus promised outside of yourself. Now to close, I want to address three potential people who might be sitting in the room this morning. If you're here this morning and you have found yourself asking questions about meaning and purpose, where to find more of that, life often does feel meaningless to you. I wonder if God might be calling you right here. Those questions, while they can be answered and found temporarily outside these walls, and other, it's not to say like covenant specifically is the only place to find this, but kind of the broader church, as we like to talk about here. But you can find temporary purposes for your life out there. But what we've seen this morning is that an eternal, forever purpose is found within these walls. Now, this isn't to say that this covenant community is a perfect one, or that you won't get hurt, or that it's always going to benefit you in particular. But it's mainly to say that this is what you have been sanctified for. So what might it look like for you to more fully embrace the y'all? And I didn't plan this out. Again, I don't work for Covenant. But there is this Discover Covenant meeting happening after the service. And I wonder if that might be the next best step for you. I think it's down the hall in the community life room. Second, if you're here this morning, you've made this community, this your community, you're part of the y'all, but there's still something missing. Maybe purpose still feels like it eludes you. I wonder if God might be calling you to consider how to serve him, again, the living God, as he's named in Hebrews, within this community. When we give of ourselves, our time, our resources, our talents, our gifts, our money, in service of the living God as part of his sanctified body, you will be taking part in true significance. And it might not always feel like true significance, but we can be confident that this is kingdom of God coming on earth as it is in heaven significance, whether it feels mundane or not. I have a friend who likes to imagine and dream about the other side of eternity and sitting around campfires in heaven and getting to just spend so much time sharing stories and talking with others that have been in and out of his life about how God was at work. And I kind of wonder, what if we, let's imagine being on that side of eternity together and getting to be with that kingdom hindsight and saying, man, when we were, are you kidding me? When we got to like serve in this way or when I was doing this, like God was, the kingdom was coming through in that. I had no clue. When we got to partner with Water for Ishmael, are you kidding me? Like maybe I didn't know these people being affected. But how did, man, God was doing this over here. Like, I can't even fathom. But I can't wait for that kind of kingdom hindsight, just because we were a people who served the living God together. So what might it look like for you to join in and serve this God with us? Third, if you're here this morning, this is your community, you've been serving here, I have to imagine that it can feel easy at times to lose perspective, to get jaded. Maybe this community starts to feel stale. Church is hard, people are messy. We're not at all immune from the ramifications and effects of sin, right? And if I'm honest, this is where I was during COVID, for sure. And I think it will, just personally, will always be a temptation for me to drift towards sort of a cynicism and apathy towards the body of Christ. Church at times can feel just as screwed up and pointless as every other institution that's being dissected and taken apart. And the temptation might be to wonder if greater meaning and purpose can be found out there somewhere, just simply on my own. Do I even need the y'all? So can I affirm in you, not as an attempt to fix those feelings, if that's where you're at, but simply by way of reminder that God has created you for meaning and purpose. This is something we do long for, and what he is offering is not temporary glimpses of meaning or moments of it, like a vacation, where we come back and we have all those emails to get back to, or there's that yard to mow, which I had to do. There's the laundry to do, all that stuff. But this is eternal, for good, for all time, meaning and purpose because of the sacrifice that Jesus made on the cross. So would you trust? Maybe that's the invitation, to trust that that is still found here, because we have been set aside so that we might serve the living God. The Lord who sanctifies us has called us to serve him. He's the living God, the actual burning bush showing up, parting the Red Sea, feeding the 5,000, raising the actual dead, capital G, God, right? My life is not my own. I've been bought at a price, as Paul says. What other choice do I have but to serve him? And guess what? I'm invited to do that among a sanctified group of people who want to live for Jesus and who worship the God who is known as Jehovah Makodesh Kem. Let me pray. God, I thank you for this community. Thank you that you are a God who invites us into your work, and that infuses us with a sense of meaning and purpose, true significance that lasts well beyond anything we could imagine. God, I pray that you would give us even eyes to see and ears to see how your ears to hear how your kingdom may be at work right here and now. Give us that glimpse of how you're at work through us, through the y'all. Bind us together. May this be a community that serves the living God and honors you. Amen.